Those of you who don't know, I'm Elmer Witt, I'm director here at Holden, and this week I've been leading discussion on the Gospel of Mark, based largely on this book, which I dearly thought was in the bookstore. I'm sorry. It's going to be there in 2 weeks if you want to come back. By David Rhodes and Ronald Mitchie. David and Ronald are on the teaching staff at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. And I've been doing this because I've been intrigued by the book for a number of times now and was embarrassed last year when David Rhodes came here and did it. And the real master did it because he has memorized the book of Mark and simply tells the story. I'm not David Rhodes, so I will be reading the story to you. That's what we've been doing the first 20 minutes or so of the session. You're asked to simply sit there. Do not follow in the book, simply listen, that's the request, so that you get a taste of the story as it very likely was simply told at that time. Then we'll have a chance to talk about that and ask you your responses and spend the rest of the time just getting into it. The chapters of the book deal with the geographical, the rhetoric that is used in the book, with the geographical settings, and with the plot, and then the characters that come across the scene in the story, and then finally a discussion of the reaction, a response to the story. So in a sense, we're doing that each day, although the story being told is just going right through the story as it occurs in the book of Mark. There are obviously other Gospels. What Mitchie and Rhodes ask us to do is, for a while, just forget about those Gospels and stick with this one. Try to get the full impact. Don't try to pick something out of the air and put it into this one. Just let this one do its job and see what happens. Okay? So we'll get started. I'll pick up with the last paragraph that I read last time. Those of you who were here recall it. This paragraph followed the beheading of John the Baptist. And after that, those sent out gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. And he said to them, "You yourselves come privately to a desert place and rest a little." For many were coming and going, and they were not even having an opportunity to eat. And they went off in the boat to a desert place, privately. And maybe many people saw them going and recognized them, and on foot from all the cities they ran together there and arrived there ahead of them. And getting out, Jesus saw a huge crowd, and he had compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and began to teach them many things. Since by now the hour was getting late, his disciples approached him and said, "The place is a desert and the hour is already late. Disband them so they might go off to the surrounding fields and villages and buy themselves something to eat." And Jesus said to them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Surely we're not going to go off and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat." He said, "How many loaves have you? Go see." Finding out, they said, "Five and two fish." And he ordered them to have everyone recline, group by group, on the green grass, and they reclined to eat by companies of 100 and of 50. And taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looking up to heaven, he blessed them, then broke the loaves apart and gave them to his disciples to set before them, and the 2 fish he distributed to everyone, and everyone ate and was satisfied. And they took up 12 baskets full of scraps and leftover fish. And there were 5,000 men who ate. And immediately he compelled the disciples to climb into the boat and go ahead to the other side of Bethsaida while he disbanded the crowd. And taking leave of them, he went off to a mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land, and seeing them straining in the rowing, for the wind was against them, about the fourth watch of the night, he went towards them, walking on the sea.
And he wanted to go past them, but those who saw him walking on the sea thought he was a ghost and screamed out, for they all saw him and were terrified. And immediately he spoke to them and said to them, "Take courage, I am. Don't be afraid." And he went up to them into the boat, and the wind quit. And they were completely stunned within themselves, for they did not understand about the loaves. Instead, their minds were hardened. Crossing over to the land, they came to Gennesaret and docked. And when they got out of the boat, people immediately recognized Jesus, ran around that whole countryside, began to carry the sick about on their mats to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he entered, into villages or into cities or into fields, they would put the invalids in the markets and plead with him that they might just touch the edge of his cloak. And as many as touched it were restored. The Pharisees and some of the legal experts came from Jerusalem and gathered around him. When they saw that some of the disciples of his disciples were eating bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, for the Pharisees and all the Jews, unless they wash their hands up to the elbow, they don't eat, thus adhering to the tradition of the elders. And they do not eat anything from the markets unless they purify it. And they do not, and there are many other things they have to receive to adhere to, such as purifications for cups and pitchers and kettles. The Pharisees and legal experts ask him, "Why don't your disciples walk according to the tradition of the elders, but instead they eat bread with defiled hands?" And he said to them, "How well Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites. As it is written, this people honors me with the lips and their hands, but their minds are far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching teachings which are ordinances of humans. Having left the ordinance of God, you adhere to the tradition of humans." And he said to them, "How well you nullify the ordinance of God in order to establish your own traditions. For Moses said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and the one who pronounces misfortune upon father or mother must certainly die. But you say that if a man says to his father or his mother, 'Whatever for me might be a benefit to you is korban,' that is, a gift consecrated to God, no longer do you allow that person to do anything at all for his mother or his father, thereby invalidating the word of God by your tradition, which you have handed on. And you do many things like that." And summoning the crowd again, he said to them, "Hear me, everyone, and understand. There is nothing from outside of a person that going into the person is able to defile. Instead, the things going out from the person are the things that defile. And when he entered into a house away from the crowd, his disciples were asking him about this riddle. And he said to them, 'Do you lack understanding like this too? Don't you comprehend that everything that enters into the person from the outside isn't able to defile? Because it doesn't enter into the mind, but into his stomach, goes out in the toilet, thereby pronouncing all foods clean.' He said, 'What comes out from a person, that defiles. For from the inside, from the minds of people, come the evil desires, fornications, thefts, murders, adulteries, expressions of greed, malicious deeds, deceit, immorality, the envious eye, blasphemy, arrogance, recklessness. All these wicked things come from inside and defile." Now from there he rose and went to the district of Tyre. And entering into a house, he wanted no one to know about it, but he was not able to escape notice. Instead, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately came up to him and fell at his feet. And the woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth. And yet she asked him to drive out the demon from her daughter. And he said to her, "First, let the children be satisfied, for it isn't right to take the bread of the children and throw it to little dogs." Which he answered and said to him, Lord, even the little dogs down under the table eat the little children's crumbs. And he said, because of this word, go off. The demon has gone out from your daughter. And going off to her house, she found the child thrown on the bed and the demon was gone. Coming back from the territory of Tyre, he went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, up the middle of the territory of the ten cities. And people brought to him a deaf and tongue-tied man and pleaded with Jesus to lay his hand on him. And taking him off from the crowd privately, Jesus thrust his fingers into his ears and with spittle touched the man's tongue. And looking up to heaven, he groaned and then said to him, Ephphatha, which means be open. And immediately his ears were opened and the binding of his tongue was released and he began talking clearly. And Jesus was ordering them to tell no one, but the more he would order them, the more they insisted on proclaiming it. And people were utterly astounded, saying how well he does everything. He makes even the deaf hear and the mutes talk. Those days when, again, there was a huge crowd and they did not have anything to eat, Jesus summoned the disciples to him again and said, I have compassion for the crowd because already 3 days they've stayed with me and they don't have anything to eat. And if I disband them hungry to their houses, they'll become faint on the way, and some of them have come from a large distance. And his disciples answered him, how will anybody be able to satisfy these people with bread out here in a desert? And he asked them, how many loaves have you? They said, seven. And he ordered the crowd to recline on the ground, and taking the seven loaves, giving thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set out. And they distributed them to the crowd, and they had a few little fish. And blessing them, he told the disciples to distribute these also. And the people ate and were satisfied. And the disciples took up seven baskets of scraps. Now there were about 4,000 people. And then Jesus disbanded them. Immediately climbing into the boat with the disciples, he went to the district of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came out and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, testing him, and groaning deeply in his spirit. He said, why does this generation seek a sign? I swear to you, surely a sign will not be given to this generation. Leaving them again, climbing into the boat, he went off to the other side, and they forgot to take bread. And except for one loaf, they didn't have any with them in the boat. And then they began discussing with him, and Jesus said to them, beware, look out for the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with each other, we don't have bread. When Jesus realized that, he said to them, why are you discussing that you don't have bread? Don't you comprehend or understand yet? Are your minds hardened? Having eyes, don't you look? Having ears, don't you hear? Don't you remember when I broke the five loaves and for the 5,000? How many basketful of scraps did you take up? And they told him, 12. And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many hand baskets full of scraps did you take up? They said, seven. And he said to them, don't you understand yet? They came to Bethsaida, and people brought to Jesus a blind man and pleaded with him to touch them. And taking the hand of the blind man, he led him outside the village and spitting into his eyes, laying his hands on, he asked him, do you see anything? Looking up, he said, I see men, but they look like trees walking. And then again, Jesus laid his hands on his eyes, and the man looked intently, then was made new and saw everything clearly. And Jesus sent him to his house, saying, don't even go into the village. Jesus and his disciples went out to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked the disciples, saying to them, who do men say that I am? And they told him, saying, John the Baptist, others say Elijah, but others still say one of the prophets. And he asked them, but who do you say I am? And Peter answered and said, you are the anointed one. And he rebuked them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them it is necessary for the Son of Man to suffer greatly and be rejected by the elders and the high priests and the legal experts and to be put to death and after 3 days to rise. And he was speaking the word plainly. And taking him aside, Peter began to rebuke him. And Jesus, turning around and seeing his disciples, rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. You're not thinking the things of God, but the things of humans. And summoning the crowd with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone wants to follow after me, he is to renounce himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. And whoever will lose his life for me and the good news will save it. For what benefit is it for a man to acquire the whole world and forfeit his life? Or what would a person give in exchange for life? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, also the Son of God will be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. And he said to them, I swear to you that there are some standing here who will definitely not taste death before they see the rule of God come in power. After 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John and brought them up to a high mountain privately by themselves. And he was transformed in front of them. And his clothes became dazzling, intensely white, like no longer on earth has ever been able to whiten. And Elijah appeared to them with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And Peter spoke up and said to Jesus, Rabbi, it's good we are here, and we should make three shelters, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. For he did not know how to respond, for they were so afraid. And a cloud came, overshadowing them. And there was a voice from the cloud. This one is my only son. Hear him. And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone at all but Jesus alone standing with them. And while they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus ordered them not to recount to anyone what they had seen until after the Son of Man had risen from the dead. And they seized on this word, arguing among themselves what risen from the dead meant. And they asked him, saying, why do the legal experts say that it is necessary for Elijah to come first? He said to them, if Elijah coming first is to put everything right, then how is it written that the Son of Man, that he should suffer greatly and be scorned? On the contrary, I'm telling you that already Elijah has come, and they did to him whatever they wanted, just as it's written about him. And coming to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and legal experts arguing with them, and immediately on seeing him, the whole crowd was alarmed, and running up to him, they began greeting him, and he asked him, what were you arguing about with them? And someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you because he has a mute spirit, and whenever it takes hold of him, it hurls him down, and he foams at the mouth, and grinds his teeth, and then withers up. And I told your disciples to drive it out, but they weren't strong enough. And he answered them and said, O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to put up with you? Bring him to me. And they brought the child to him. And upon seeing him, the spirit immediately convulsed the child, and he fell to the ground and was writhing about, foaming in the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, how long has it been like this with him? He said, from childhood. And often it has thrown him even into the fire and into the water in order to destroy him. But if you're able to do anything, have compassion for us and help us. And Jesus said to him, if you're able, everything is possible to one who has faith. And immediately the father of the child screamed and said, I have faith. Help my lack of faith. Now when Jesus saw that a crowd was running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, mute and deaf spirit, I order you, come out from him and never enter into him again. And screaming and convulsing him violently, it came out. And the child became like a dead person. Said, most said, he's dead. But Jesus, grasping his hand, raised him up, and he rose. And when Jesus entered the house, his disciples privately asked him, why weren't we able to drive him out? He said, this kind, it isn't possible for anyone to drive out except by prayer. Going out from there, they were passing through Galilee, and he did not want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be handed over to the hands of men. They will put him to death. And 3 days after he put to death, he will rise. And they did not comprehend the saying and were afraid to ask. They came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, what were you discussing on the way? But they kept quiet, for they had discussed with each other on the way who was greatest among them. And sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone wants to be most important, he will be least of all and everyone's servant. And taking a little child, he stood in their midst and putting his arms around it, he said to them, whoever receives one such little child in my name is receiving me. And whoever receives me is receiving not me, but the one who sent me. And John said to him, teacher, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we were stopping him because he wasn't following us. And Jesus said, don't stop him. For there is no one who will do a work of power by my name and be able soon after to pronounce misfortune on me. For whoever isn't against us is for us. Whoever offers you a cup of water based on a name because you belong to the Anointed One, I swear to you that he will definitely not lose his reward. And whoever causes one of these little ones who have faith to stumble, it would be better for him instead if a large millstone had been tied around his neck and he had been thrown into the sea. And if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life maimed than with two hands to go off to Gehenna, to the inextinguishable fire. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter into life lame than with 2 feet to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pull it out. It's better for you with one eye to enter into the rule of God than with 2 eyes to be thrown into Gehenna, where their maggots don't die and the fire isn't extinguished. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if salt becomes saltless, how will you make it season? Have salt among yourselves and be at peace. Once again, I'll ask you for about 2 minutes just to talk with one another and share some of your reflections, reactions to hearing that section of Mark's Gospel. Can you do that, please? Now, I wonder simply if some of you would be willing to share what some of your responses were so others can hear and maybe have an exchange about that. In the process, I want to do a little talking about the plot that's been developing all the way along the line, but I'd rather start with some of your reactions. Anyone? Here, go ahead.
I'm just amazed that I've read this a number of times, but this time it became clear to me, personally at least, how difficult, really difficult, all these miracles are for the post-enlightenment mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized this time in listening to it that they're almost a stumbling block for us. They really are. And it was helpful for me to think this time about the motive. Not that the act itself isn't very, very important, but I think sometimes we focus so much on the miracle itself, the doing of it, that we forget the motive behind it. And the way he explains the compassion Jesus had for these people, you know, they haven't eaten for 3 days. Look at them. If we let them go, what would they do? Listening to this, for the first time, the motive was stronger to me than the action itself.
I see.
It was almost a secondary thing that, okay, he fed them.
Mm-hmm.
But not how did he feed them, but he fed them. But more importantly, he cared so much about them to feed them.
I had that sense. I think today the sentence, don't tell anybody about this, that always confounded me. Today it was very clear.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you say, it's not the upsetting actual law of the importance. He can't help it. He just has to do it. So he's sort of trapped.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and the other thing, too, it's very interesting when he says, for this generation, and he's just done all these miracles.
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, for this generation, there will be no sign.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Someone else? Want to respond to that or add anything else? Please.
I always think about the people who didn't get fed, mm-hmm. who didn't get food. And for those of us who are involved in justice ministry, there's always that struggle with being immobilized because of the seemingly impossibility of feeding food and or changing the structure so that everyone is able to be fed. And the miracles are really helpful for me in seeing them as signs of the kingdom, that in those miracles there is a little glimpse of what the kingdom is about, and that is that all are fed and that all are good. And so for me that becomes a really important way of understanding my own ministry to create glimpses of the kingdom in the midst of really a very broken world.
Someone else? Yes, please.
I'm impressed with the power of the miracles. On the other hand, I'm impressed with, again, the limitation of Jesus. I'm astounded to hear intended to heal a blind man, and the first time around did sort of a half-baked job. Seemed like, I don't know exactly what that means yet for me, but it's comforting in a way to think about doing ministry and seeing that often it doesn't work out as perfectly and neatly as you intend in giving care to people. Even Jesus had his days.
Yes.
It's also amazing to me. I read the gospel and I always try to picture who the gospel was written for. Now the story is about Christ dealing with his time, but this gospel was written for people 30 years later. And the writer is saying, look at these disciples. Christ is doing handstands and they don't see. He does the miracles and they just don't get it. You know, they are really dumb. And part of the problem seems to be the story of Peter's profession. and it's nowhere linked as well as in Mark. He says, you are the Messiah, the Son of God. In the next breath, he's trying to tell Jesus the way he should be Messiah. Isn't maybe that's what that particular community was trying to do, trying to interpret Christ for themselves. And sometimes I find ourselves trying to do that. Instead of trying to get inside and pray to Jesus and see what his message is for us today, we try to pretend omniscience and without prayer, without reflection, try to explain what the Gospels really mean and go out and do this or that work. And then we're flabbergasted that they are ineffectual ministries because it's the way we would like things to be. And I see sometimes that our failings are because we have gone off with our own idea of what salvation is rather than what Christ's idea of salvation is.
Does that mean we don't look at this from the post-nuclear world or the world of walking on the moon? Don't we have to bring all those experiences to this too?
Definitely, but I think in light of prayer reflection on the Gospels don't say anything about nuclear war or apartheid. They give us general principles. Jesus came to be a good Jew, but also to explain a new way of living. And we have to reflect on the message he has. And in reflecting, in prayerful reflection, I think he will point out the application today.
What Rhodes and Minch do in connection with that, in discussing the plot, they try to make clear, I think it is clear, but maybe that's because I've been hanging around their book for a while, that the plot has to deal with Jesus bringing the news of a new way, a totally new life that was diametrically opposed to what most of them understood, what most of them expected, and certainly what most of them wanted. And that was the backdrop for it. And then there were all kinds of, in the foreground, there's all kinds of these conflicts going on, certainly with the authorities, certainly with even his own family, certainly with the disciples, conflict with the creation, with nature, conflict probably within himself. And that was all going on. And then these little the vignettes of all of that make that plot more intense, intensifies, it builds. If you just let that thing happen, you know he's different. He's not only able to do different things, he does different things for different reasons. And his goal is to set it all right. He is not satisfied. It is not God's way that people be sick. It is not God's way that people be hungry. That's what the signs in this gospel of the new kingdom. And now that gets him into trouble. Gets him into trouble with the disciples and in trouble with all the rest. The authorities had a good case against him. Good case. He was taking on himself authority that they really didn't have any way of knowing that he had. They didn't hear the voice from the cloud. They didn't understand that he was fulfilling writings from the old time. They hadn't been around at his baptism. And then he waltzes in and starts forgiving sins, which for them at least only God could do, or the high priest. He starts attacking the Sabbath. The temple and the Sabbath are the two basic institutions of the religion of the day. He's a wiseacre in answering them, tricks them all the time. They had a good case. This guy's messing around with basic stuff. And they were right that they were. Or the disciples, too. I like the section that Nietzsche and Rhodes do with the disciples. if you look at it from the disciples' side, they sacrifice a lot. They show determination to remain loyal. They follow him to Jerusalem. They didn't jump off back in Galilee and go back to the nets. They stuck with him. It's a weird kind of a thing. They do have this hardness of mind, but Jesus is not so superior as it is that the task is so difficult. And so they both harden up and they're scared as can be. Whether Jesus will succeed in making them good disciples or not is really what part of the story is about. It's a good case can be made that the disciples got too much too fast. They never told who he is. He didn't tell them out directly. We don't have a record of that. Maybe they did, but Mark doesn't bother to tell us. Expectations are high. They're supposed to catch on. They're supposed to cut through all the junk that they received from their life in parochial school or wherever else they went. They are reprimanded. I don't think there's any compliment to the disciples. You know, we got the psychology tells us today, all we do is compliment people and everything be right. No biblical basis for that. That's a psychological insight. May be good, may not be good. Jesus reprimands them constantly. Doesn't say, well, you're doing well, but no way. He just says, how in the world don't you understand? What's wrong with you? When he warns them, when he tells them what's really coming down in Jerusalem, they're hooked. They're way up in Bethsaida. They've bought into his whole system. He says, well, now what's going to happen is we die. And that's a tough hombre. So the conflict is very, very strong, it seems to me. What it's about, I suppose, as somebody said in the early session, is showing us we wouldn't have gone. We wouldn't even gone along. We'd have hopped off. A couple of the experiences in the boat, we said, see ya. We're going to go. And so there's a positive disciple side. In fact, in spite of the fact they see it all. How many baskets? 12. How many baskets? 7. In spite of all of that, there was a big jump. Because it wasn't simply nice Jesus. No way. It says the whole system is rotten. Everything is bad the way it's going. Including all this illness. Including all this hunger. Including the system of the government and everything else. And it's got to be, all of it's got to be changed. Beginning with you. That's a big order. So the conflict is really, really deep. Yeah?
Well, he's expecting so much in this section. He's giving so much.
Mm-hmm.
We're constantly feeding people with minimal food. We're constantly healing people. He's really a contrast in high expectation but high generosity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a, I think mm-hmm. he's doing that. Mm-hmm. There's a reason to that. He's modeling after the disciples. But we think of him as so stern and strict, but look at what he's all giving in this mm-hmm. section.
Jesus assumes they will have faith, right? And is surprised when they don't. At least that's what the marking text tells us. But I sure agree with you. He's giving like everything all the way along. But we always want to be careful to have a nice God, comfortable one. But there's a lot of discomfort right alongside of the giving. Someone else?
That phrase about saltiness mm-hmm. this time, more than it has in the past. Just now when you said, nice God, I can remember a criticism of Christianity as being sacred and our Christian communities sometimes being cotton candy, you mm-hmm. know, with it's lovely and we have a good time together. And yet Jesus isn't talking about sugar, he's talking about salt. And salt is sort of a caption to all of those stories mm-hmm. that you were relating about dealing craftily with the legal experts mm-hmm. and challenging the disciples.
Mm-hmm.
there's a little sharpness with sparkle in mm-hmm. what he says, and then he throws it out and says, you mm-hmm. are the salt of the earth. Mm-hmm. You know, now if you lose this, you haven't got anything to share. We've got to figure out a way to beat that again.
Sure. Some problems with that salt passage, because I wonder what the implications are for the time right now when we have religious political groups such as the moral majority. What happens when the majority are salt, so that the whole loaf is salt?
Mm-hmm.
And what then is the role of the church in society when, how do you be salt if you're the whole loaf? And what does that have to do with the our call to mission and to baptism missions?
Mm-hmm.
All of these questions.
Somebody? Yeah.
I don't know if it's an answer, but it makes me think when you're talking about salt and when you're talking about the moral majority of the contract there, a little salt goes a long way. And you think when Jesus says that you have faith the size of a mustard seed, and you see then how far away we are from that. And in thinking about salt, we're talking about high expectations of Jesus and the high, what he can do. But in contrast to the gifts that we're given, what's expected of us, even though it seems incredible, it's not. So you wonder how much, when you talk about the moral maturity, you wonder, where is overkill? Where is too much salt? Where does that turn into exactly what kind of community? And that's really a, you know, almost a personal thing. It's a real difficult question.
I'm glad Jesus didn't say that we're the pepper of the earth, because then we'd all think we're hot stuff.
Seem to accomplish that without pepper. Some more, any more on?
Well, to continue, like, I always find this helpful. I can't remember who it was. Some liberation theologian talked about the fact that we need to be the leaven and the lump. So, I mean, if you want to continue your bread analogy a bit more, if the whole loaf is salty, then maybe we need to be the leaven that's off in the corner getting ready to yeast again. And go back into the loaf one more time. So I don't know. It's the same kind of thing about being the remnant within the
mm-hmm.
the larger piece of fabric. So
and salt slows down the action of the leaven too. So there's that kind of contrast.
So I don't know that I'm ready to say that the whole loaf is salty. I guess.
In fact, I think Mark underscores the reality of us being a fallen world. So that's never going to be a possibility.
And I
get a feeling of frustration.
Can you go back? I think that Mark, that's what I saw.
Would you say it again?
Say it again.
I think Mark underscores the reality of the fallen world, where things are never fully saturated with God's kingdom here. And I get a sense, as you read this, of the real frustration even of Jesus trying to bring the kingdom of God into this fallen world. Even the inability to having to work twice to heal this guy's vision. Almost symptomatic of a frustration that Jesus feels in trying to get this stuff done. And surely the disciples represent that. They don't catch on. And the way you read that was dramatically was good. You could feel the anger and frustration of Jesus and their inability to understand. So I think Mark would suggest that there never will this world be so permeated with salt that it will be pure.
Yes?
This dawned on me just as you were saying that. If you look at the legal experts of the time, you had a moral majority then. They were going around looking over everybody else's shoulder, telling them what they were doing wrong, and really
banging them over the head with the idea that this is the law and you're out of the law and who's wrong and we're right and righteous. And Jesus' saltiness wasn't in castigating wrong, it was in the simplicity of his idea of God's kingdom. When he took that little child and he put his arms around it and he said, you know, while you're over here arguing about whether you have to wash your hands up to here or up to here, whoever takes this little child in, he's the closest person to the kingdom of God. Salt is something that kind of cuts through the rest of the taste to make it clearer. And Jesus' simplicity was able to cut through all of this, all these layers of stuff that people build around their concept of God and religion and say, here it is, here's the center of it. You know, just this very simple, take care of your neighbor. You've got that piece of bread in your pocket, put it in the basket and that'll feed everybody. You see a little child over there, put your arms around him. Somebody is sick, take care of him. And the simplicity of that, I think, is the saltiness, not the going out there and drumming about we're right and you're wrong.
I think it's interesting, too, Jesus continually trying to provide understanding. And I think of this in the context of healing the blind man, where the blind man says, well, they look like trees walking. And the question that comes to my mind is, is that because he wasn't already all the way healed and there was a blur, or because he had never seen in his life, and people, in fact, looked to him the same way as his conceptualization of trees walking? And then Jesus works more on the eyes, but you wonder, did he change the vision then so it was more clear, or did he give the man understanding to comprehend that vision? And that's something I've wondered about a lot. What's really going on there?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I had once thought about that halfway or half-baked, as it occurred to, healing, that is something I try to read into the writing of the Gospel of Mark, and I just tell you and see, you know, what you care to think about it individually.
Okay.
There is something beautiful about a tree here at Holden. You can look around and see these majestic trees. And also, people have thought, when you're fed up with your fellow human being, that there's something repulsive about your neighbor, as in Jonathan Swift saying, I love humanity, but I hate individuals. And I think also of a statement by Beethoven, I can't give you the source of it, but he said, how much better a thing a tree is than a man. That they just felt, if you're looking at a tree, what are you going to fault it? That it grows, it's alive, it's beautiful. And very soon when you're standing in line with somebody and they're impatient and you're impatient, you can be abrasive, or they can be abrasive to you about individuals. But it would seem that if somebody who didn't see the truth was lifted up one level, he would see human beings as excellent as trees. But then trees don't have free will, and they're beautiful creations, but it almost says the human being, the new man, that the whole gospel is saying, here's a different picture of man, is so much better than that, that then he sees clearly. No matter how wonderful trees are, if only people could be as reliable as trees, that you're never bothered by them, but we're something more than that. Like the stage, this is good, but look, I'm telling you something you never knew. Man is even more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But whether that's written into it, that
okay. Somebody else got a response to that, or something further on that? Go ahead.
I've got something further on the feeding of the multitudes. Mm-hmm. There may be a different miracle here that one doesn't ordinarily see. If a group of 10 of us were to go down here that Jesus was going to be down at Lucerne to talk, and someone came in from Stehekin, Chelan, and Comanche, and they all hiked in, since that's a long hike to see Jesus, what would we do? We'd all pack a big lunch to make sure we had plenty of food when we got there. I have a feeling that people in those days wore tunics in which everything that they carried was covered up under the tunic so nobody could see that they had food present. After you got there and people would be sharing a little bit, but then the food begins to run out, or it's just a case of the worm coming in and all they've got is five loaves and two fish or whatever. Jesus might have recognized that all those people had plenty of food, but since they didn't know whether anybody else had any food, the miracle was getting these people to share what they had. And getting the boy to say, well, we'll bless this food and share it. Then there was plenty for everybody, but nobody knew anybody else, and so you didn't know whether anybody else had anything. And there might have been enough for everybody's need, but not enough for everybody's greed. And that might be the miracle of eating. That's not the kind of miracle we usually concentrate on.
Yes?
I like that interpretation, and if that is the correct one, then it's a far more powerful thing for us, because it was simply his willingness to open up and start sharing, even though it didn't have much, that broke everything loose for the whole group. That tells us a lot more for our present day than if it was some supernatural act, which wouldn't have much to do. This is a model that we could follow, and big things might happen from it. I think that's the kind of salt that we need.
And then we participate in this miracle.
We're willing to share the talents we have in the next miracle.
Someone else?
Maybe that answers the question. When you first said you always study about who the story was written for, it's written for you. You know, mm-hmm. You just explained that.
Mm-hmm. Another question that comes up is how serious, everyone says, well, how serious was he when he said to chop off my head?
Mm-hmm.
When I've always thought he was very serious. As serious as you were about staying out of hell, that's how serious he was about chopping your hand off. Mm-hmm. How serious are we? To what lengths will we go? Mm-hmm. Where do we stop? Where do we give in and say, well, I can get by, you know, I'll stay out of hell and don't have to go the full distance. I think that was his message. But, everyone says, well, he really didn't mean that. But I think he did. I think he was being very serious.
Surely he comes off as being, again, if whatever it is that you're getting into, if you have to cut off a hand or whatever it is that is the most worthwhile whatever there is. There is nothing else. Because all the other stuff, it's worth losing in order to have this. So as Jesus' primary message in Mark tends to be, is the rule of God being established, that's the thing that sets the standards for all the priorities, all the, you know, whether you need two hands or hands or whatever it is. Everything is established right at that point. And I think, again, when we were talking about, a little bit of miracle here, a little bit of miracle there, we get caught in all those things rather than that all of this was about, as these people were saying too, all it was about that establishment of the new way of doing everything. And that is the only worthwhile. For me, that part of the story says, that's the only worthwhile thing. There is no other, even something like sight. Thank you very much.
Thank you.